Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that tries hard to maintain a sense of self, especially during this era in which it seems that the world, each day more and more, has lost its collective mind. Last week, that process was complicated by our watching three very different movies. Each in its own specific way, though, examines the complicated nature of what it means to be human. First up is the drama Judas and the Black Messiah, followed by the comedy Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, and finally, the documentary A Glitch in the Matrix. Let's begin this week's show by turning the clock back to the late 1960s. It was during that turbulent decade, particularly in the city of Chicago, that another difficult period of American history was taking shape. In August 1968, the infamous riot-torn Democratic National Convention was held. Then late the next year, the city's ongoing racial strife was capped by the shooting death, some would call it an assassination, of the Black Panther leader Fred Hampton. Judas and the Black Messiah, co-written and directed by Shaka King, focuses not just on Hampton, played by Daniel Kaluuya, but on a man named William O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield, a low-level criminal who had been recruited by the FBI to infiltrate Chicago's Black Panther chapter. King's film not only benefits from the powerful performances put in both by Kaluuya and Stanfield, but it manages to transcend the normal biopic style by striving for a feeling of accuracy, delving deep into the complex qualities that drive each of us in our real lives, not just to survive, but to thrive.
Yeah, it's interesting that Judas and the Black Messiah is the third movie that we've spoken about in, the last 4 or 5 months that, you know, is dealing specifically with the political and the racial strife of this moment in history, you know, 1968, 1969, and kind of trying to untangle all of the complex emotions and themes that were emerging in that era. So first we had Trial of the Chicago Seven, then we had Mangrove, which was one of the small acts films that we talked about, and now Judas and the Black Messiah. And of those three, this is probably my favorite. And I think that what it has to say about its era and what it has to say about the historical figures that it's dealing with, and obviously fictionalizing for the purposes of a narrative, I think it has the most to say. And here, you know, we talk a lot about historical dramas and whether the characters feel like real people or whether they just kind of feel like conduits for 21st century filmmakers to get out their big ideas about the past. And certainly Aaron Sorkin was doing that in Trial of the Chicago Seven. Here, I think the characters really feel alive to me in a way that they rarely do in these sorts of movies. They don't act as if they're historical figures, you know, that their history has already been written. They feel vulnerable. They feel contradictory in a lot of ways. They're messy. And you look at Fred Hampton, who, I mean, Daniel Kaluuya, it should be said, is incredible in this movie. He's like, I think, a decade older than the actual Fred Hampton ever was, but it doesn't really seem to matter because he embodies this guy so much. But he isn't virtuous, even though not entirely virtuous, even though his mission obviously was. And we kind of see how he's grappling with, you know, the idea of having to become a public figure in this fraught time in order to get any of his missions accomplished. And I think that that performance is really interesting. But on top of all of that stuff, I mean, there are scenes in Judas and the Black Messiah that play out almost like a thriller, even though we know what the outcome is going to be. And I'm specifically thinking of a scene that comes about halfway through. Once O'Neill has successfully infiltrated the Panthers, there starts to be talk of a mole within the organization. And there's some kind of irony in that he is an informer and he's working within the security branch of, you know, the Illinois chapter of the Panthers. And his fellow, well, not really fellow Panthers because he was only a Panther by name, but they start to get suspicious and they're kind of questioning him and they force him at gunpoint to hotwire a car to prove that he's really a criminal and not just some FBI stooge. And scenes like that are really exciting, even though I know that Bill O'Neill isn't going to get caught. There's still, you know, an hour and some change left in the movie. But the fact that Shaka King, the director, is able to make me feel that kind of immediacy means that this isn't just some kind of, you know, stodgy historical document. It's a real drama with real people in it. And maybe we can get more into Bill O'Neill, because he's a fascinating character too. And the way the movie deals with him was not what I expected. So yeah, I'm a big fan of this. It's streaming on HBO Max. I don't think we've said that yet. I would actually like to see it a second time just to kind of let all of its themes kind of unpack themselves further.
You know, I couldn't agree more with everything you've said, Nathan, particularly the portrayal of these two guys, because as you point out, Kaluuya's portrayal of Hampton makes him human. And largely, I believe that that's facilitated through his relationship with Deborah Johnson, who ends up being there the night that he's assassinated, 9 months pregnant. And that whole scene plays out really dramatically also.
Yeah.
So, you know, I obviously with any sort of biopic, there has to be fiction. You have to go back and recreate scenes. You have to telescope the time frame. You have to make up dialogue, because we don't know, except in speechifying that, you know, was likely captured either on audio or video or both. But still, it's incumbent upon the filmmaker to make it seem real. And King does a really good job of that, as do both the performers, and specifically Kaluuya, but then also Stanfield, because his Bill O'Neill is, you can never really figure out what's going on with this guy. And we should probably add at the end of the film, there's in usually the kind of things that I don't like, but what I think works really well in Judas and the Black Messiah is that there's snippets of the real people. And there's the one single interview.
Eyes on the Prize.
Yeah, Eyes on the Prize with O'Neill. And he still doesn't give anything away. So was this guy committed? Was he a criminal? Was he all of those? And was he ultimately a narcissist and a sociopath who had his own survival at the fore? And that was what he was most interested in. All those things may be true. It just is, I think, credit to the complexity that the way Stanfield plays him that it intrigues us so much.
Yeah, I went back and forth on whether it was a good strategy to focus almost as heavily or more so. I think Lakeith Stanfield has top billing, because we see Daniel Kaluuya to have gotten these nominations for Best Supporting Actor. So I think that the William O'Neill character that's the star turn, or that's the leading role. So I went back and forth about trying to figure out, should we be valorizing people such as this? I mean, I think it was integral to the story, but at the same time, I think I would have felt more comfortable if the focal point remained on Hampton. And I realize I'm one of the few people saying something such as this, so everyone can disregard it. But that was sort of a choice that was a little puzzling to me. I also think, Dan, that you're right. I mean, William O'Neill was trying to figure out who he was. I mean, he started out as a criminal, and then all of a sudden, you know, he's thrust into this completely alternate role, but he really sort of self-identifies with his past and with his contemporaneous relationships with people in the Black Panther Party and so forth. And then we find out, if you know through history, that things do not ultimately end well for him after he goes into the witness protection program and so forth. So I think this was something, despite the Eyes on the Prize to interview, I think this is something that tortured him and tormented William O'Neill through the rest of his life, because he ends up in a situation that was ultimately declared to be suicide. So I don't know. I mean, I think that there's so much to like about this film. I just probably am like one tick less enthused than the two of you are about it. And I'm still processing it. So that's a good thing.
Well, see, I think it's important to put as much focus on the Judas of the title as much as on the Black Messiah, because I think, at least in this film's interpretation of history, I mean, I think that Bill O'Neill was sort of in a lose-lose situation, at least as the film
absolutely
portrays it, because he can either become another statistic in the, you know, the prison industrial system, or he can, you know, possibly have his books clear, but it means, you know, selling out his own people. And so he is kind of between a rock and a hard place, and we do see him wavering. But I think that the use of Bill O'Neill as an informant is just, as is the case with the way that they eventually killed Fred Hampton is illustrative of the FBI exploiting race. I mean, they're basically using Bill O'Neill's blackness as a weapon against him and a weapon against Fred Hampton. So I think the way that this movie uses him as a character, it's less of, oh, we have to show both sides, as trying to illustrate, no, the FBI's influence was, it was so poisonous that it was able to get both of these guys basically using each other. So I think the movie has a little more subtlety on that front than
fair enough. We also didn't talk about Jesse Plemons, who I thought was a perfect FBI agent. I mean, and he plays William O'Neill, sort of, he's almost like a father figure in some respects, and so you can understand that as well, the bad father.
And anyway, that was our review of Judas and the Black Messiah. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar and A Glitch in the Matrix. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Judas and the Black Messiah. Let's now move to Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar and A Glitch in the Matrix. Let's begin with a trek to a faux Florida. That's Florida by the way of Mexico, which is where most of the outdoor locations of Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar were filmed. Typical of many films made by Saturday Night alumni, Barb and Star, which was directed by Josh Greenbaum, from a script by Annie Mamolo and Kristen Wiig, isn't just a comedy, but a farcical, at times sci-fi-themed satire of the very kind of comedy it impersonates. And typical of SNL itself, it falls flat nearly as much as it evokes a laughter. Mamolo and Wiig play the title characters, BFFs, who have never left their Nebraska small town, yet end up vacationing at the Florida resort town of Vista Del Mar. And on their way to self-realization, they end up not only getting embroiled in, but actually, spoiler alert, foiling a scheme to commit mass murder. Wiig is the SNL veteran, and she shares credit with Mamolo as the Oscar-nominated screenwriter of the 2011 comedy Bridesmaids, an extremely successful film that is superior to Barb and Star in pretty much every way possible.
This is not Bridesmaids. So it's been 10 years since Bridesmaids came out. And so I just want to tamp down people's expectations in that regard. Because what Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar presents to us are not these big moments or these gross out fests, but rather I think the pleasure in watching Barb and Star are the small moments, because they do get so many things right. I mean, as you point out, these are best friends from Nebraska who are going on a big adventure, which happens to be Florida. To give you an example, en route to their vacation destination, they're on the plane. And of course, everyone else is half snoozed out and they're just chatting away. And that just struck me as so realistic, because I think all of us have been in that situation where you just want to tap somebody on the shoulder and say, hey, did you notice that no one else in this entire plane is talking except for the two of you?
That's certainly true of you and your friends. I'll grant you that.
Okay, isn't it also mind. Like even worse is when two strangers start a conversation on a flight and they just talk the whole time. I don't want to talk to anybody on a plane.
I know.
That has nothing to do with anything.
That's the side, but that's the point that I was making is there are these realistic and funny moments throughout this movie, but I think it does not reach the heights of Bridesmaids, nor will much else out there ever probably do so, because I think that is truly a classic, you know, women's film. But in this particular circumstance, there was too much sort of going on that didn't quite come together. So it's sort of weird and it's funny, but it's not a complete film. I guess that's what I would finally say. I do like the fact that Annie Mamolo is in the movie because she and Kristen Wiig do, as you indicated, have this rapport with one another. And I think that that's important. And they seem like ordinary people. And I liked that a lot. Of course, then we get Jamie Dornan, who comes in. And
who I liked so much.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely adds something to this whole film. But to say that people should pay $19.99 to see this, I don't know. And I'm a huge Kristen Wiig fan.
Well, I'm not going to compare this movie to Bridesmaids, but I'm going to compare it to one of my favorite dumb comedies, which is Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion. I love that movie. I've probably seen it 20 times.
Agree.
We quote it all the time in this house. And I mean, that's another silly female-driven buddy comedy that also kind of has this, you know, origins in sketch comedy and improv comedy, and also has these weird flights of fancy where, as you said, it almost becomes like a science fiction film every once in a while. And maybe this will have the same kind of cult future as Romy and Michelle does. I didn't like this nearly as much as that movie, but I did have some laughs because, I mean, it is very, 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 very times a thousand silly.
Weird.
And very weird, and sometimes almost too self-consciously weird, where they thought, what's the weirdest thing we could come up with? Yeah, and it just kind of seems like random humor, very similar to something like Hot Rod, which is another kind of, you know, the Lonely Island SNL kind of movie. So some of this stuff is really funny. There was one line at the beginning, like right out of the gate, where I thought, I'm going to love this, where they're talking and one of them says, it's in the middle of the day, and they say, isn't it crazy that all the raccoons in the world are asleep right now? And I don't know why, but I just thought that was genius. But none of the stuff with Kristen Wiig's supervillain and the mosquitoes and all, none of that worked for me. That felt like something out of an Austin Powers sequel.
Yes, exactly. I
did not like that. But Barb and Star, I liked. I think this is an extremely your mileage may vary kind of movie. You're either going to find this really annoying or you're going to think it's genius. So, it sounds like we're kind of in the middle. So maybe.
Yeah, we're both at once, I think. At any rate, that was Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Let's close with A Glitch in the Matrix. In his 2012 documentary, Room 237, filmmaker Rodney Asher examined all the ways that film fans interpret Stanley Kubrick's 1980 film, The Shining. Here, Asher tackles the nature of reality itself by looking at the possibility that the movie The Matrix wasn't mere fiction, that the world around us just might actually be a computer simulation. He does this by interviewing scientists, philosophical thinkers, and for an extended period, including snippets of an archival lecture delivered by the paranoid free thinker and late sci-fi author Philip K. Dick. Come to think of it, though, in his efforts to explore the reasoning behind this seemingly nutty movement, Asher does offer an intriguing proposition, one that certainly would help explain the last 4 years of American history.
Oh, well, yeah, and this is in keeping with Asher's style, because he just kind of steps back and lets his subjects kind of unwind and kind of let it all out, like he did that with Room 237, as you said, but also The Nightmare, which was about people kind of explaining their sleep paralysis dreams. Is a terrifying movie.
The difference here being that he almost in almost every single instance, some of the more weird of these people are portrayed in the movie as CGI configurations.
Right. Like they're alternate, you know, avatars matrix that they're in. Yeah.
Like they're a automaton or something.
And that kind of approach, I mean, it works sometimes and it doesn't work others. Right. I mean, you do kind of start to wonder, like, is he endorsing these ideas? Because he's not like stepping in or pushing back or like vocally editorializing. But I do think there are enough like cutaways within some of the archival footage you're talking about to people sort of, you know, looking askance at Philip K. Dick or Elon Musk, who also features a lot in this film. So I think you kind of get the idea, the notion of what Asher thinks about all this. But I think that the movie is kind of ultimately pretty unfocused. It's also way too long. This felt like maybe it could have been a short instead of a feature film. I was checked out long before it was over. And there's this whole like really disturbing kind of third act that involves a guy who became convinced, he was like a teenager, he became convinced he was in the Matrix and he murdered his family. And it takes up a lot of the movie and it's really unsettling. And I felt like that was almost a different realm of argument all together. And I kind of see what he's doing, but I don't think that it all gels together. So maybe it's because I'm just not that interested in the central subject. So I didn't really go along with it like I did with his Shining film. So,
well, and of course I was fascinated by this because it does basically involve a cult. Yes. And so it had two features of things that I appreciate watching: cult, and then someone who mass murdered a group of people.
Oh my God.
And he's related. So what could go wrong?
That's good Lord. Theory
on this. But the thing that was most intriguing to me is the fact that how people would take events in their lives, and it ran the gamut from being in this sensory deprivation tank, which, you know, I've done those float tanks and nothing nearly comparable happened to me. And then they have this epiphanous experience, and that's when they decide that this has happened. I mean, maybe it's more reflective of some sort of psychotic break that triggers their response to what's going on around them. I don't know. But I agree with you, Nathan. It was too long. I think the whole subplot dealing with the guy who loses it and becomes, a killer probably deserved its own showcase of some sort. I don't know what that would be.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. But I'm still fascinated by the director's fascination with people who become obsessed. And so I'm curious about what that tells us about him.
Because this is just another conspiracy theory, right? It's just a way of trying to find order in the lack of order that our universe has, essentially. I mean, that's what Room 237 was basically about.
Yeah. Right. So he has many opportunities to continue this theme going forward, should he choose to do so, because we have numerous examples of people who seem to be in the Matrix, or maybe I'm in the Matrix, or maybe I am the Matrix.
Yeah, that's right. There are so many computer simulations. And I think you checked out, Nathan, there, because somebody hit Control-Alt-Delete on your computer. So just saying. At any rate, that was our discussion.
Good one.
Glitch in the Matrix. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed Judas and the Black Messiah and Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. Until then, remember these words from, again, the late Aldous Huxley: to see ourselves as others see us is a most salutary gift. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.